This is Zone 1 Radio's Email from America. This week, cycling in the USA. And no, there won't be a Miley Cyrus parody. Oh, it's cycling in the USA. Inspired by a recent edition of our sister show Sports Zone, this email from America takes a look at cycling in the USA. In the next hour, we'll visit Revolution Cycles, one of the largest bike retailers in the Washington, D.C. area. And one of our correspondents will check in from Austin, Texas, with the latest on Lance Armstrong. There's some terrific music, and then there's me, your host, Zeph. Now, I'm a new voice on Zone 1 Radio, and yes, that voice. As you can tell, I'm an expat, and like all expats, I have a nostalgic view of my homeland. I'm unquestionably enthusiastic about my adopted land, and then I have one of those voices that weaves from Green Park to Greenland and back again. Part Ryan Gosling, part Ryanair cabin crew. Now, ladies, if you were wondering, thanks to the magic of radio, I am the spitting image of Ryan Gosling. Anyway, it's my job to file a report from America for everyone living back in the smoke. Ooh, didn't I just refer to London as the smoke? Isn't that the kind of slang now only used by expats like myself? While I don't deny that in the words of Swing Out Sister, it's better to travel, and I suspect that will be the first of many obscure 80s pop references that will appear in the email from America, I do like to think that having been born in the great London borough of Hackney, that my Cockney credentials are, well, not beyond reproach, but enough to get me in the door. Coming up, whoa, cycling in the USA. Oh my God, singing with that accent. Stop it, please, stop it. Now, lean over your white picket fence in your average American suburb and tell your neighbor that you're getting a bike. More often than not, he'll ask if it's a Harley or a Rice Rocket. And when you consider that more people probably saw E.T. fly across the sky on a BMX than actually own a bicycle, then it's safe to say that cycling is a subculture rather than part of the culture. But little by little, that might just be changing. Cities all over the states are doing the best to, if not embrace the cyclist, then at least make him or her feel a little less the leper. New York City, the Big Apple, are pledging to add 300 miles of dedicated bike lane by the end of the decade, while bike share schemes are flourishing from D.C. to L.A. And yes, we do like our initials here in the United States. Detroit, home of the big block V8, the hometown of Ford and Chevy, the birthplace of the motor car, well, their bike share scheme signed up over 800 members within 3 hours of its inception. Still, the sad fact is less than 1% of the American workforce commute by bike, so for the moment, the bike still belongs to the BMX Bandit and the Triple Rush bike messenger. And while it's safe to say that here in America we'll never be at the point where it's four wheels bad, two wheels good, there is hope that from the fixed gear to the $5,000 carbon fiber racer, there's a future for the bike that goes beyond being a substitute for the step machine and the treadmill. Coming up next, we're on the road at Revolution Cycles. Revolution Cycles was established by Mike Hammond-Wright and Santiago Pinky Gonzalez over 15 years ago. The two men set out to create a unique bike store that could greet and meet the needs of both enthusiast and the enthusiastic. With over four stores in the Washington, D.C. area, it's clear that that goal of commercial success married to their mantra of wearing shorts as many days of the year as possible has come to fruition. I traveled to their flagship store in the urban suburb of Clarendon, just across the Potomac River and the Capitol. There I sat down with operations manager Katie Knight. All kinds of different bicycles here. Describe to me a little bit your stock and what moves out the door.
Sure. So we've got four different locations, and each location varies a little bit in what we sell as far as the bicycles. But for the most part, we carry a variety of Trek, Felt, and Raleigh bicycles. The bulk of the bikes that we move are going to be hybrid-oriented bikes. So the bikes that work well with multi-purpose in mind. Our customers are commuting to work, they're riding with the kids, they're riding the paved trails in the area for the most part. We also do a fair amount of road bike sales, A little bit with mountain bike, and the two categories that have started to pick up a bunch of traction in the past 2 years are triathlon and cyclocross.
Is it seasonal? What moves out the mm-hmm. door?
So we're firmly planted in an area where May to September is where the bulk of our business is done. There's no question. We definitely still have customers that continue through the colder months, but everybody's out and riding May to September until the first kind of cloudy, cold day in October. The types of bikes that we sell will vary a little bit per the season as well. So our triathletic customers tend to come in the fall, just as we're moving out last year's models and we're starting to get in the new stuff. And our cyclocross customers tend to come in at the end of the summer, just as their season is picking up. But other than that, I would say that our business is just seasonal in the sense that we do most of it in the summertime.
Is there a type of buyer that you see coming in predominantly in terms of, obviously, you've talked about how the triathlete segment is growing, and so mm-hmm. triathletes come in, mm-hmm. but are you still getting sort of the person that walks in the door and goes, I don't own a bicycle, what should I get?
Absolutely. There's a large percentage of our clients are folks that are extremely intimidated about walking into a bike store. And part of our goal is to bring that intimidation factor down and let people know that that's okay. And that's why we're here. So we're happy to talk to the gearheads and the folks that want to know about the latest, greatest thing that's out. But one of the joys of my job is I get to take a person that hasn't been on a bicycle since they were a kid and show them how we can introduce biking into their life for their purposes. So absolutely. But the first thing you got to do is let the customer know that you're interested in making a connection, not a transaction. And once that's done, you gain the customer's permission to interview them. So the opposite of the situation here. And I would ask them a bunch of questions that they would know the answers to. So you don't have a bicycle, but somehow you became interested in getting one. What was it that you thought you might do with that bicycle? Where would you go? How often would you ride it? Where would you be riding it? For how long would you be riding it? Where would you store it? Is there any chance that you might use it differently in the future? Those answers are going to help guide us. We've got 700 bicycles in our flagship location. That's a lot of choice, and it's overwhelming unless you know what you're doing.
And obviously, I would assume that everyone here on the staff is obviously enthusiastic mm-hmm. about bikes and riding, and I guess at some level that helps with a customer walking in, that they can see in the personality of the people that work here that it means yeah. something to us emotionally.
Yeah, absolutely. In the bike industry, you will not be able to hang around for very long unless you have a passion for riding. There's people and sharing that passion. That's the draw. That's why we do what we do.
Can you talk to me a little bit then about some of the events away from selling and maintaining bicycles? We talked a little bit mm-hmm. beforehand about group rides. What do you do as a series of stores, as a company? It's beyond a transaction.
Yeah, we do a lot, actually. There's in the DC area, there's a lot of bike shop competition. And in order to have a successful bike shop, I think it's important for your brand to have its own personality. And so hopefully what we communicate to the world is, I guess now officially,
yes.
Is that the Revolution Cycle's personality is about getting butts on bikes. Whatever kind of bicycles those are, we're just pleased that people are riding. And so we put on ladies' night events. There's some statistical information out there that shows that the rate of accidents in a community goes down when more women get on bicycles. It doesn't change when more men get on bicycles. So what happens is there's a correlation between women making a community safer when they're riding bicycles. And we like to be a part of increasing that statistic. So we have ladies' nights in our stores, usually annually. And we have head mechanics that teach bicycle maintenance courses in the wintertime when things slow down for us. We like to show up at community events. So when we're invited to races and rides, we like to have a tent out there. And then weekly, we have multiple shop rides out of each of our locations to continue growing the cycling community in our area.
I noticed that you guys ran a city hub program. Can you explain what that was? And I think it's better that you explain it than I try and regurgitate what I read on the web. But there was some interesting concept ideas that you guys threw around here.
A few years ago, we opened a teeny tiny location just outside of Washington, D.C., near a metro stop in a community called Crystal City. And the idea behind it was that we were going to provide a bicycle share to the residents and the folks that worked in Crystal City. We had...
Now, let me interrupt you. Did the DC bike share program already exist in that location?
It did not. In fact, it didn't exist at all quite yet. So we were a little ahead of the DC bike share program, which, at the end of the story, sort of created the demise of our one little shop. But we're kind of happy it did. And so I'll get there and explain why. We opened this little bike share that operated for a small community. And then if you wanted to rent bicycles, you could as well, so at a larger rate. If you had a bike that needed service, we could service it there. And if you wanted accessories, we had those as well. We actually opened that location knowing we were going to lose money. We knew that the rent and the amount that we were going to pay our employees and the amount of business we were going to do was not going to add up to a positive number. But the owners of the company thought it was important to provide a service like that. And so we did. And we had a lot of fun. We ran a lot of events. Talk about lowering the intimidation factor. As a customer, when you walked into that shop, there were no bicycles being sold. And so we had a lot of folks that we won as lifetime customers because there was no work involved in bringing that intimidation factor down. Then just about a year after we opened, the Capital Bike Share program opened up, and they are extremely successful and they're doing a really, really wonderful thing. And it made our little tiny community bike share program not necessary anymore. And so we're very pleased that Capital Bike Share is as successful as it is and is continuing to grow. But a loss that we budgeted for in the company then became a greater loss. And so after a couple years of running that location, we did need to shut it down.
I'm going to ask you for personal opinion then.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that a booming bike share program, does it hurt bicycle stores, or do you feel that actually in a weird way it may create new customers who decide, I don't want to be riding the rental. Mm-hmm. Why don't I walk in here and maybe buy one?
It very clearly helps the bicycle industry. When the Capital Bike Share first was announced, we got a lot of questions from customers and local media about how concerned we were going to be about it. And it was really quite the opposite. Everybody's excited about it. So when you plant a bunch of bicycle stations in a community, the folks who are riding also need to buy helmets, and maybe they need a different bag solution on their way to the metro or to work. And then maybe they do it a few times a week and decide that the cumbersome, maintenance-free Capital Bike Share bike is great for a few trips. But if they really want to introduce cycling into their life, maybe they need something that's a little bit lighter weight, that fits them a little bit better, that they could use on a trip if they wanted to take a vacation. And so it's really something that benefits the entire community.
Final question for you. I think I already know the answer to this. Is this job a labor of love for you?
Yeah, it absolutely is. I grew up in this area riding bicycles with my family, and joke, my father got me into it when I was in my teenage years. The only thing we could agree upon was a bicycle ride. And after a little bit of racing and in my 20s, a ride across the country, it's something that's always been a part of my life. So I'm very pleased to have a career that involves something that I love so much.
That's terrific. There actually was one more question. When are you getting your winter socks on the shelf?
Just a month away.
For the last decade, the name Lance Armstrong has surpassed the sporting achievements that accompanied it. But rising stars burn up just as spectacularly when they re-enter the atmosphere, and Lance's fall from grace has been more dramatic than the original climb to the top. Joining us from Austin to talk about the city's relationship with its fallen son, his store Mellow Johnny's, and the future for Lance Armstrong, our at-large correspondent Cameron. What's the relationship between the city and their favorite son?
Hey, Zeph. It's a great question. It's been an interesting evolution to see here in Austin. You know, Lance, there was, I think much of the city for a while was defined by him, you know, with such incredible success on and off the bike. You know, you see his, you still see his image around in different places you go. So there's a mall here where, you know, there's a cyclist in a yellow jersey, and there's nothing to figure out who that is. Big electronics store you go in, and there's a caricature of him up on the wall. So I think much of the city for a long time was very much defined by him, even though it's the state capital of Texas, one of the biggest universities. Is based here, but still, when people thought of Austin, they thought of Lance Armstrong. So, and you know, his evolution here, you know, from beating cancer and then forming his own cancer charity, put him really at the top of the celebrity and best known people out of Austin, and frankly, probably out of Texas, next to George W. Bush and the Bush family. And, you know, what you've seen since then, since he admitted to doping, you know, the transformation of people's opinions of him has been pretty drastic. So I would compare it before the doping. There weren't many people. I'd say people like you and I were pretty skeptical, since you and I follow cycling very closely. We followed it for many years, and we're aware of things like the Festina incident before Lance really came to prominence, when the whole Festina team got kicked out of the Tour de France for doping. You know, brought to light that doping was a big part of cycling. But, you know, I think people kind of look past that when Lance, you know, overcomes cancer and becomes the biggest story probably ever in cycling, that someone can beat cancer and win the Tour de France and then win it over and over and over again, that people really were passionate about his success and didn't want to necessarily believe that he could have cheated. And, well,
let me ask you a question on that sort of mentality. Obviously, as you said, you and I both followed cycling, and we kind of made a educated guess when he won his first Tour de France that there probably wasn't something quite above board about his performance. I think it's safe to say that you and I beat the Sunday Times, L'Equipe magazine, and Oprah Winfrey. We beat them to the punch by about 12 years in figuring out that he was cheating. Let me ask you a question then about the people in Austin. Do you think they were living in denial?
Yeah, I would say they were no different in Austin than they were anywhere else in the country. And so, you know, I would tell you about times where I would get on message boards and I would challenge some of his results, and I would get skewered by people. And that wasn't in Austin. That was in various parts of the country. I would have exchanges on Facebook with friends on other parts of the country. And again, it was strong and adamant. I think some of it came from, I think a lot of it started from obviously his story of beating cancer. Then he wrote his book. His book empowered people to know his story, and then they would basically throw it back at me when I would bring it up. So I would say people in Austin were no different than they were in other parts of the country. They said they had the same fervor. They really came up with the same arguments that other people did in other parts of the country. So I don't think they were any different. I think when he announced that he was that he did dope, I think their reaction was similar. to other parts of the country that people, I think it went beyond disappointment. I think people were angry. And I did sit down with several people here and talked about it in Austin, about their feelings towards him. And it was, I mean, their anger might be a little bit soft of a word, that they were, I think they felt duped. I think they felt insulted, that they fell for this guy, that they spoke up for him for so many years. And then all of a sudden he comes out and and says he did cheat. And I think that's reflected in the press as well. I think the press became very aggressive in attacking him. And it reflected how I think much of society did here and the people in Austin as well.
Talk to me a bit about his business presence and also his positive or negative effect, specifically now through through his fall from grace on cycling in the city of Austin.
Yeah, his business presence, really the only business presence I'm aware of is, well, the two, the Live Strong charity. And then the other one is, as you mentioned, the Mellow Johnny's cycling shop. And that store is located in the heart of Austin. It's actually about two blocks off of a major where a lot of entertainment and bars are located. As far as that store, you walk in and you know you may not. I actually, when I first walked in, I had no idea that he owned the store. And I walked in and then I saw 7 Tour de France yellow jerseys signed by Lance Armstrong, and I kind of figured out, well, I think I know who's a part of the store. Really, other than that, I don't see any other presence. I don't think his announcing doping has really hurt his business there. I don't imagine. I don't have any empirical data to support that. But like I said, people still, due to the location and it's still a good cycling store, people probably still maintain going in there. As far as cycling in general, I'll go back to where I lived previously, and that was in California. The culture in California, at least in Northern California, is cycling. I don't think it's as pervasive as it is in Europe as far as a way of life. I think as a sport, as a form of exercise, it is. It really is, I think, a big part of the culture in Northern California. In Austin, it's a little different. The roads aren't necessarily bike friendly. You go out for 15 minutes outside the city, and you're on roads that have no shoulder. There's not necessarily a safe place to ride in many places, and so you don't really see many cyclists on the road outside the city. When you're in downtown Austin, there aren't necessarily many bike lanes available. You don't see many cyclists cycling around. You and I have talked about the cycling culture in the past, and you've seen lately that fixed gears have become very popular. It's especially for the young, probably 18 to 25-year-old, that having a fixed-gear bike is popular, and I saw it all over California. You still see it somewhat here in Austin, but, thinking that it is Lance Armstrong's hometown, you would think that cycling would be much bigger than it is. And that's always surprised me that there are cyclists, they go out on rides, there's some serious cyclists here, but it isn't nearly as pervasive as I would have expected it.
Do you think there's redemption out there for Lance Armstrong in the next 3 to 5 years, even in Austin? Do you think people are ready to forgive and forget, or does the anger run deeper than that?
Yeah, that's, you and I have debated that many times. Can he get redemption? And I remember reading an interview, someone had talked about one of the people in USADA had talked about Lance coming and talking to Travis Tigard. And Lance apparently saying that his redemption is in his own hands. And he's absolutely right. Redemption is in Lance's hands. It's really a question of, is he willing to pay the price in order to get that redemption? And I say pay the price because in the Oprah interview, he did admit to doping, but he also talked about times when he didn't dope. And he was pretty adamant about his comeback and things he was doing where he was absolutely not doping. And what happened was, a few days later, Tiger from USADA came out, the United States Anti-Doping Association came out and said that, well, in fact, we know that he was doping. And between that and then the many lawsuits that have been brought up, I can't remember who actually brought them up, but I believe he's going to court in the very near future to try and hold on to some of the earnings he had earned. That he's in a tough spot because I believe they still have evidence that he did dope when he said he didn't. And he may lose quite a bit of money, and I think he's still trying to cover his ass and make sure that he doesn't lose anymore. So I think if he came clean, I think if he was absolutely forthright in everything he has done and started to talk about the problems and all the ways that they cheated and really became, I think he could become a beacon of light in all of sports to go from, the greatest champion to one of the greatest cheaters to turn around and say, become the greatest advocate against doping. He's in a position to do that. But like I said, I think he's still trying to hold on to some of the things that probably some of the money that he's earned. And by doing that, I think it makes it very difficult right now in the next 3 to 5, maybe even 10 years for him to do that. Maybe someday, he decides that he's put enough of that behind him and that he can become that voice. You see here in the States, you've got baseball players being suspended. Some of the greatest players, in this current generation have recently been caught for doping. And I think in football, you get suspensions on a regular basis for doping, for taking performance enhancing drugs. And I think there are a lot of sports that see it outside of cycling. And there's an opportunity for someone to be that beacon of light to say, this is wrong. This is not just wrong for professional athletes, but this is wrong for amateur athletes. He can play that role, but like I said, I think he's too tied up in his past to be that beacon, but that beacon of light in doping would allow him to get that redemption.
So, now we get to the email part of the email from America. Those of you of a certain age will have figured out that this is a shameless ripoff of something already done and done better. Tip of the hat, Sir Alistair Cook. So, why don't we just agree to call it an homage? What is it Chumbawamba saying? I get knocked down and I get up again. They were from Burnley, but they might as well have been from Baltimore because there is nothing that we love more here in America than a comeback. The only thing better than watching someone get to the top is watching them make a God almighty hash of it, fall on their asses, and then climb the mountain all over again. From Bill Clinton to Robert Downey Jr. to Tiger Woods taking an iron in his hole in one, there's a fascination in watching the attainment of success followed by a fall from grace. Falling off the perch is ideal, because that means in true Hollywood style, there can be a sequel in the form of redemption. Clinton 2, Downey Part 3. Or is it part 4? I've forgotten how many times he's been to rehab. How about Woods the Return? Now, it's probably true that there is nothing quite as exhilarating as an underdog story. Ask people in Wigan. But in reality, for every Hoosiers, for every Bad News Bears, there's a whole bunch of underdogs that got their teeth kicked in as they're sent packing whence they came. What makes the comeback the most desirable of storylines is the high level of probability that it will turn out all right in the end, because the fella's on the comeback trail, he's already proven talented enough to scale the heights. The only thing America loves more than a winner is a guaranteed winner, and the added spice of the fall from grace makes the end dish all that more satisfying. Bill Clinton was a two-term president who presided over an economy that boomed, but thanks to a girl in a blue dress, he's almost a beloved figure now. Tiger Woods won 14 majors until his missus found his little black book. When, or if, he wins his 15th, we'll be the ones in an orgiastic frenzy. I saw Mike Tyson with Matt Lauer on the Today Show the other week, the real-life Rocky, as it were. He's been up and down more than his Hollywood doppelganger, so while it's uncertain if he'll ever make a comeback stick, he's definitely value for your entertainment dollar. And so to Lance Armstrong. He's at the bottom now, and the jury is out on whether he'll wear redemption in the same proud way he wore those yellow jerseys. See, for a comeback to be truly satisfying, you need to be known for your original achievements. And Lance's problem is that it's those very same achievements that are flawed. Clinton was a two-term president who cheated on the side. Lance, on the other hand, well, cheating was his daytime job. For Lance, it is all a little more cloudy. Mike Tyson is many things, but he does have Bradley Cooper in The Hangover as his moment of public reacceptance. Lance has Vince Vaughn and Dodgeball, but he made that when he, and most of us, were still in denial. I don't doubt that Armstrong will get his redemption in time. If Oprah's had you on once, she'll have you on again. And ultimately, what made Armstrong so compelling in the first place, the cancer survivor who conquered the world's toughest endurance event, that'll trump the fact that he had a couple of illegal legs up along the way. The court of public opinion can be a tough place to make your case, but deep down inside, we love a comeback. I did say there'd be more than one 80s pop reference this edition, so how about Don Henley's and Dirty Laundry? Kick 'em when they're up, kick 'em when they're down. That's it for this edition of the Email from America. Thanks this week to Katie, to Cameron, and our music coordinator, Sam. Talkative music. One song this week didn't fit. If you can tell me which one and tell me why, you will have my everlasting admiration. So until next time, keep an eye on your inbox. And as they say at the U.S. Navy's Top Gun Fighter Pilot Training School, have a bandit day. Come on, man. And with the look-